Ben Helfgott, Reel 3.
So I used to spend a lot of time in the evenings with my parents and with neighbors. So I spent a lot of time in the presence of older people, and I used to listen very attentively to their discussions, deliberations, and I learned a great deal. It was a kind. It was a great education, and in some cases, in fact, as time went on, I used to even make a contribution, because I was running around always in the ghetto, and I used to get outside the ghetto, and from the time I used to start reading, I got into the habit already before the war. I used to stop at the kiosks where they used to sell newspapers, and I used to read all the whatever I could see that was displayed. And of course, during the war, they still had the kiosk and they still were selling newspapers. Of course, it was all controlled and it was all German propaganda. But nevertheless, there were interesting stories. And I used to read these stories, and I used to come back, and I used to relate these stories to everybody. And of course, when they realized that I had a retentive memory and how much I was telling them, they used to ask me and they used to encourage me. And the more I was encouraged, the more I used to tell them about what was going on. Of course, my mother disapproved of it, because she realized that I used to spend a lot of time outside the ghetto, and she was very unhappy about it. But still, the point is that that again was part of my growing up, my awareness of politics and what was going on around, and possibly one of the reasons why I still remember so much from those days. Now, but life in the ghetto really was hell. I might give the impression that it's from what I say that we settled down and we accepted it. We had no option. We had to live, and we had to live the best way we could. Some managed and some did not manage. Some went under and some were swimming, and some did better than just swim. From what I'm telling you, obviously you can see that I was in a much, at this stage, in a much happier situation than perhaps other people may have been, because first of all, I did not feel the hunger to the extent that others did, because my father was dealing with food. Secondly, I was with my family, I was protecting my family, but the fear was always there. Whether I went outside the ghetto or whether I was in the ghetto, I was always frightened, irrespective. It wasn't a question of bravado, whether I forced myself to be out. I was frightened when suddenly somebody looked at me. When a German looked at me, I thought he's going to stop me. He's going to ask me who I am and what am I doing and so on, whether it was in the ghetto or outside the ghetto. So I was always walking around with fear. And the Germans had a way of maltreating us and demoralizing us in a way that it is really difficult to understand for anyone who really has not gone through it. Because first of all, as I said, they used to make these periodic searches and periodic attacks. They used to come in and they used to catch people at random and send them away. Nobody knew where they sent them, whether they shot them or whether people are going to come back or not. And just when everybody thought that these people, they're never going to hear from them, people used to turn up. And just when they thought they were going to come back, they said, oh, it'll only take a day or two. People didn't come back. So nobody was really certain what the next day is going to bring.
Where had these people been?
Well, they were sent to different kinds of camps workplaces. They used it used to happen very often during the night. We were asleep and suddenly we knew that they were knocking at the doors. They were trying to get young people to send away for a few days' work. So even the nights were not safe. We used to live on the third floor, and the kitchen window went into the attic, and from the attic one could go onto the roof. My father was a very nimble and very agile man, and he developed a scheme whereby as soon as he heard something was going on, and so being on the third floor was always a help, because it started off from the ground floor. When we heard that that there is a search going on, and they're seeking people to be for work. He immediately jumped onto the to the attic, and from the attic onto the roof, where he was lying on top of the roof, waiting until it was all over. But what they used to do, they used to collect the people in the courtyard when they had thought that there's no more people to be caught. They used to take them away. One of the nights that I remember very vividly, and which has had a very profound effect on me as well, was when, you see, I was not affected at this stage, because I was about 11 years old when this was happening, 11, nearly 12. And that particular night, when they knocked at the door, my father was already on the roof. They came in, they searched, he wasn't there, and they went down. Whilst this was going on, suddenly I heard people singing. And the people, those who were rounded up. And they sang a song that, for some reason or other, I have never heard before, or if I did have, which I should have heard, it hit me for the first time. And it happened to be the anthem, the Israeli anthem of today, the Hatikva, that is a hope. And when I heard it, a shudder went through my spine. It felt something very strange, because they didn't sing it. They sang it with a feeling of nostalgia, a feeling of fear, a feeling of defiance. It was all combined together. And today, not just any time, but whenever I listen to the Israeli anthem, the first scene that comes to my mind, when I stand there, I can't help myself. First of all, I can't help myself, I have to sing it. And then I see the people, they come back to life. And I hear their voices. And it all comes back to me. So, if I do remember as much as it is, all these scenes, really, that bring it all back. So I really live with it, whether I like it or I don't like it. All kinds of association of ideas. This is one of them. But this was had a very profound effect on me, because I then discovered that was the Jewish national song. And of course it had a much greater meaning. And when somebody translated to me the words, that even had an even greater meaning to me. It all brought about a greater resolution in me as well. Because from that moment on, I sort of felt that if the war were to survive, that there is only one solution for the Jewish people, that they must have their own country, that they don't suffer again. But these are thoughts. But what the Germans used to do, they used to, as I explained earlier, there was, for instance, one officer, German officer, who had a black Alsatian dog. He trained this dog to go straight for men's testicles. Now, when he used to come to the ghetto with the dog, the ghetto, within seconds, became completely deserted. Everybody ran for their lives. Whoever did not manage became almost castrated. And he used to get tremendous pleasure. He used to stand there watching what the dog was doing. Now, one day, I was going to see a friend of mine, and I walked into a courtyard, into the building where he was living, and there was a courtyard, because there were lots, as I explained, there were lots of courtyards. Buildings at courtyards. And to my amazement, astonishment, I saw this German officer with a Jewish policeman with whom he was friendly. And this dog. When I saw him and this dog, I nearly died. I thought to myself, that's my end. I was glued. I was rooted to the ground. I simply could not move. And this policeman knew me. The Jewish policeman knew me. And this German officer shouted out, "Du, was machst du hier? What are you doing here?" And I really couldn't even utter a word. Turned around and I said, "I'm going to see a friend of mine." And then he said, "You're going to see a friend? Do you know that Poles are not allowed to come here?" I said, "But I'm not a Pole, I'm a Jew. If you're not a Jew, why don't you wear your armband? You see, every Jew had to wear an armband. You see, where we were, we had to wear an armband on the left hand. The band with the David star. In other places, they had to wear the yellow David star on their chest. So I said, "I'm Jewish." So he said, "But well, if you're Jewish, why don't you wear your armband?" I said, "Well, I'm not 12 years old yet, because we had every Jew from the age of 12 onwards. In fact, I was about two months younger than 12. So he says, "You're not Jewish? You're Jewish? And you say you're under 12? Prove it. Bring your birth certificate." Well, I didn't believe him. I was absolutely convinced that the minute I move, he will set the dog on me. And I just wouldn't move. Anyway, this Jewish policeman said to me, "Come on, it'll be all right. Go on." Well, I went off. I got home. I told my mother. My mother almost died. And I said to her, "Look, I've got to take my birth certificate. I've got to show him." Now they said, "But how can you go and see him?" I said, "He's took my name and my and the address where I live." Mother gave me the birth certificate, and now, of course, I was frightened to meet him, to deliver it, because not so much that he's going to see it, but the dog doesn't understand. When I went down, I heard that he was in somebody's place. So I got there. The dog was next to him, and I shouted to him, and he said, "Okay, you let me go." Well, what I went through that day, I mean, again, I'm talking about it now as if, you know, well, just as an ordinary story. But I was so terrified that nothing can ever describe what I've just done. Anyway, so these were the kind of situations that used to happen all the time. If it wasn't me, there were others. They used to come in, they used to take out people, they used to shoot them. When there were Jewish festivals, during the Jewish festivals, that was one of their pranks that they used to, but that they thought they would play on us. They used to come, take out people at random, take them away and kill them.
Would they kill them in front of you, or would they take them away?
Well, usually they would take them away, but occasionally they didn't hesitate to shoot people in front of others. There was no... Since there was no punishment for them, I mean, on the contrary, they were rewarded for it.
What was your reaction to seeing people shot?
You see, after a time, you become anesthetized to it. What can you do other than lose your own life if you throw yourself or you want to do something? You really become anesthetized. You get used to living with fear as if fear does not exist. You get used to living with hunger as if hunger does not exist. You think about it, you live with it, and then it becomes a norm. There's nothing else, because that's what you think. Life was very limited. The area of movement was very limited. But in spite of it, We defied the Germans in so many different ways. Like I said, my father used to smuggle, so did many others. He wasn't the only smuggler. We had books that we used to read. We had concerts given in private, clandestinely. There were amongst us people of who were great musicians, people who were great actors. Plays used to be put on. And all this used to be done in private. There were recitations, meetings, discussions. All this we did it under the penalty of death. Or not everybody, some people, just they always would kill some one or two as a lesson to others that others shouldn't do it. But in spite of it, wherever possible, we used to defy the Germans, and we took our risks whenever the risks were risks with a chance of survival. Now, I mentioned about the epidemic, but this epidemic kept on dying down, and then it revived. And this took the toll of a few thousand people. There were those, as I said, who came earlier and to dying off. And the synagogue was a place where it was constantly full, was replenished. As people were taken out and buried, so new people were going in there. And they were taking their time, their place. It was only a matter of time before they would be. It was a constant to and fro of death. But that wasn't the only place where people were dying. There were other places as well. But this was really the black spot. Now, this went on like this until 1942. Now, at that stage, the German decided about the final solution. Now, of course, we didn't know about the final solution at the time. We know now that at the beginning of 1942, the Germans met and decided that they're going to liquidate the Jews. And there's no coincidence that this happened to be the height of German power. This was at the time when the Germans were in Leningrad, in Stalingrad, as far as Stalingrad, at the time when they had the whole of Europe in their arms, the time when it was touch and go in Africa, El Alamein, and so on. And they were so sure of a thousand-year Reich that they thought that they're going to get away with it, and that was the reason why they made the decision. That seems to me one of the main reasons. They set up these extermination camps, like Belzec, Treblinka. There was a place called Kowo, which where most of the people who lived in the part of Poland which was incorporated into the German Reich, a lot of Jews who lived in Lodz and around there. And of course, they, at that stage, Auschwitz was set up, but Auschwitz was not exactly, although they killed, I guess, a lot of people there, 4 million, it was not considered an extermination camp, because many people, comparatively speaking, came out of Auschwitz. When I talk about an extermination camp, from the extermination camps, very, very few people came out. And the one that I'm referring to now is Treblinka, because that is where the majority of the Jews from central Poland were sent to, and where they met their deaths, and the people in my hometown. Now, by the time the deportation came to my hometown was October, and that was October the 14th, 1942. There, in summer already, there was talk about it, that there is going to be a deportation. Of course, one didn't talk about Treblinka. We were told that they're going to resettle us. They're going to send us to the conquered lands of the Russian prairies, where we'll be able to live there.
Did you know about Treblinka at this time?
No. No, that's... there was talk about extermination, but people just simply didn't believe it, didn't entertain it. Now, there was also talk that those people who are going to be left behind in the ghetto are going to be the ones who will have work, and those who will who work for the Jewish administration, that's the Jewish police and the Jewish sanitary police and so on. Now, my father planned that we will go into hiding, we'll go outside the ghetto, because he knew a lot of Poles, and he arranged that we'll go into hiding, because he paid, this was for payment, it was not a question of hiding because of goodwill. It was, of course, there had to be a certain amount of goodwill, but without the payment, it wouldn't happen. Now, by about summertime, we were told that there are no more places of employment. But if there were some, they were at a very high premium. Again, you had to buy in. Everything you had to pay for. I wanted... a few of my friends went to work a few months before in a glass factory. This was one of the... There were two glass factories in my hometown. They were already before the war, they employed a few thousand people. And during the war, they started employing Jewish people. And I was, my friends told me that this is it. No more people can go and work in the glass factory. Well, I happened to hear my father saying that the director of one of the glass factories was a very good friend of his. In fact, he was the son of a baker. And my father used to do business with bakers. He used to sell them flour. This was a Polish baker. And this baker and this director was about the same age as my father, and they used to be good friends from before the war. So my father said, "Oh, I can always, if need be, I could always get there, get a job there, and I could get one for you." So when I heard this, I said to my father, "Look, I want to go and work in the glass factory, because my friends are working in the glass factory, and what's more, they told me that they are not accepting anyone anymore." And I wanted to prove to them what a marvelous man my father is, you see. So I told my father, and I said, "Look, I want to go to work." My father said, "No, I've already made arrangements that we all go into hiding outside the ghetto." I said, "No, I have already told my friends that you can fix it, and you're not going to let me down." Okay, my father said, "Fine, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go and get you the job there. But when the time comes, you will come with me." I said, "Fine, whatever you want," I said, "but I don't want my friends to say that I'm bragging about you." So my father was as good as his word, went to see this man, because my father had a pass to go outside the ghetto. Ostensibly, he was supposed to be delivering rabbit skins to the Germans, but he really wasn't delivering it. He was really paying a lot of money for that path, and somebody else was delivering. But that gave him permission to be outside. He brought me the path, and I went. In about the end of June, beginning of July, for the first time, at the age of 12. I was going to have a full-time job. I was so excited about it. I couldn't wait to get to work. I don't know what I was imagining. What I didn't know what to expect. It was something very exhilarating. I was allocated to work night shift. And my mother said to me, "Look, you go to sleep during the day, because you're going to be very tired in the evening." I said, no, I won't be tired. I was playing, I was running around. I said, go to bed. No, I didn't go to bed. I didn't go to sleep. I went to work. I arrived in the glass factory. It's the first time I ever went into this place. It looked very strange to me in the night. People on a platform, a big furnace. Well, lots of furnaces, but this was one of the largest ones. With glass flowing all over, people singing. Very strange it would look to me. I was allocated the job with a Polish Meister, who's sort of a foreman of a group. They're all sort of foreman, one in charge of a group making glass. It happened to be also one of the most anti-Semitic of Poles, and one who used to give hell to every Jew who was working for him. And I got a job which seemed very simple. I had to, it was working with a mold, and I was sitting just below the platform. There was a furnace, the platform, I was sitting below, on a piece of concrete. There was a bucket of water, large bucket, and I had a wooden mold. I used to put the wooden mold into the water, put them to the mold so that they would then make, the mold was a mold of a glass, and so the mold doesn't burn. I had to put it in the water, in and out, as they when making a glass.
To cool it down.
Of course, what used to happen was, this was summer. It was a very warm summer. The heat from the furnace was very strong. So my body was perspiring. The smoke from the mold was affecting my eyes. I had tears flowing down my cheeks. And on top of it, I couldn't keep my eyes open. And at this stage, the Poles who were working with me, or I was working with, started having fun with me. Every time I did not put the mold quick enough, they were higher up on top of me. They used to kick me. And they used to swear at me. Of course, they used a language which I never heard in my life before. It was swearing language. Every other word was the equivalent of effing, F this and F that. And they were so mischievous, constantly mocking at me, laughing at me, making me look inadequate. And here I was, 12-year-old, when I think back about it,